Hi, this is Michael Sinoff with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How to Make Sure Your Finances Are as Good as Gold, No Matter What Happens to the Economy. Back in the early days of the United States, a $20 gold piece would buy a man's suit, along with a shirt, a tie, a hat, shoes, and an umbrella to go with it. That same gold piece today buys the same amount, but if you paid in paper, $20 wouldn't even come close. That's because precious metals, like gold, maintain their purchasing power and are one of the strongest investments you can make in any economy. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about it from precious metals expert David Morgan. According to David, very few people realize just how bad the recent financial collapse was on the United States. There are clear and definite signs that countries are losing faith in the U.S. dollar. And in this audio, you'll hear what those signs are and the steps you can take to make sure you're safe. You'll also learn what exactly is the fiat money system we use today, how is our money backed up, and what it all means for you. You'll learn why David thinks the Chinese have been secretly buying up gold and what he thinks they plan to do next. You'll learn a quick idiot's guide to the economy, along with a look at the only options we have for getting out of this mess. You'll hear the scary truth about the Federal Reserve, the shady way it was established, and how the U.S. Treasury has to borrow money from it, all the issues surrounding it, and how it all affects you. You'll learn the complex financial concepts broken down into layman's terms such as inflation, deflation, hyperinflation, derivatives, currency debasement, and more. You'll hear exactly when David says the United States broke the trust with the rest of the world and what he predicts will happen next. You'll also learn the one quick read book David says will give you 95% of his precious metals knowledge in about an hour. According to David, this is the only time in history that there is not a country with currency that's backed by precious metals. We may be in uncharted waters right now, but there are ways you can protect yourself and create stability in your own finances even as the dollar continues to fall. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about it. Now let's get going.
Hi, this is Arthur Robinson, Jr. I teamed up with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com to bring you the greatest interviews on subject matter you won't find anywhere else.
Good evening, everyone. This is Arthur Robinson, Jr., and tonight I have a special treat just for you. I have a wonderful person on the call. His name is David Morgan, and he's a precious metals expert. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome David Morgan to the call.
It's great to be with you, and I'm sure that I'll do my very best to educate your listeners about precious metals, why they're important probably now more than ever. I'll probably talk about some of the history behind the metals and also how the economy's going and why the metals are so vital in today's economy.
What I would like to know, and can you educate the listeners about who you are and what do you suggest in terms of how can the listeners take advantage of the precious metals sector?
Well, it started a long time ago for me. I'm past 50 right now, and actually what got me interested in the silver market or in precious metals was as an 11-year-old kid, I was receiving 25 cents a week from my dad for watering our orchard, and I don't know what it took. You know, when you're 11, an hour seems like a long period of time. Probably took a couple hours, and we were pretty far out of the country, and there really wasn't any place to spend those quarters, so I just saved them and just took them out of my piggy bank once in a while. But this day came along like no other day, and this day I got a quarter from my dad, and it was noticeably different. It was a cupro nickel, what I've referred to since as the Johnson slugs, and this was a coin that has absolutely no silver in it whatsoever. It was copper and nickel, and it was plated, so it looked silver in color, but it had no real intrinsic value. I mean, copper's got some intrinsic value, but very little. Certainly not a quarter's worth of value. So that kind of startled me. Even as a kid, I thought, geez, this doesn't seem right, you know, and it certainly can't be equal. it seemed that nobody was paying attention to that. And that question about why did this happen and what does it mean kind of stuck with me for quite some time. And then when I got into grade school, I started exploring it more under, you know, what the Constitution says about lawful money and, you know, should be gold and silver. And so it was a kind of a quest that started at a very early age that I pursued basically my whole life. And I found things that were very startling to me about how the system works. So I pursued that, started reading about the monetary system. Again, it was rather startling to find out that the basics of our system are what's called a fiat system. And I use that word very often, but a lot of people don't know what it means. The word fiat actually means by mandate or by government decree. I like to think as a joke the Kunta Kinte story where King Kunta Kinte goes out to the ocean and commands the waves to stop. You know, he's issuing fiat to nature, you know, and of course nature doesn't pay any attention to him. But in our world, in the world of money and finance, as long as you can get the people to believe that a piece of paper has value and you con enough people, then it does. And that's the situation that we're in. And this situation that we're in right now is very, very tenuous because they always fail. China was one of the first to start on a paper or a fiat money system. And this is one of the great inventions that the world traveler Marco Polo discovered when he went to China. Of course, he saw many tons of interesting things and people and art and items he'd never even experienced or thought of before when he traveled China. But one that impressed him the most, or among the most, was that they were using paper to do transactions. And when he came back to Europe, he brought that knowledge with him. And so then he started to see paper currency starting to be used in place of physical gold and silver. And the funny thing about China, if you will, is China's probably done the paper money experiment more than any other nation. They've done it 8 or 9 times and has failed 8 or 9 times. In other words, every time they've gone on a paper system or a fiat system where the edict from government is that it has value and the truth is it does not, the system has failed. And when these systems fail, they bring a great deal of heartache to the citizenry because, you know, one day you're believing that this paper has value and will purchase something you need now or in the future, and then the next day it's basically worthless. And now what do you have? Nothing. All your savings dries up overnight. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is going to happen overnight here, although I wouldn't say that it couldn't, but we usually get the slow loss of purchasing power, which we have and we've seen for quite some time.
You mentioned the Chinese currency. Are you referring to the yuan?
Well, I'm talking all currencies now, including the yuan or renminbi as it's also called, are fiat currencies. There's not a currency in the world anywhere that is backed by silver or gold or has any intrinsic value or any backing. So it's a worldwide phenomenon. And if you look at my website, I wrote an article called Dollar.com pointing out this problem. And what has concerned me the most when I started, you know, really getting into this study was that this is the first time in recorded history that it's a worldwide phenomenon. And what that means is that this time around, you have no escape valve. In other words, as bad as it was during the Weimar Republic's hyperinflation, you still had the opportunity to go off to Austria or France or Spain, or you could have escaped the country and escaped the problem. And some people did, not many, but some. But this time around, the reserve currency of the world is the United States dollar, which means that China has about $1.7 trillion in the United States dollars, and Japan has lots, and all the countries, all the banking systems worldwide use the dollar as their reserve. So if the dollar goes down, they all go down. And that is what caused me so much fear, actually, is that this time around we're in a situation where it's not going to be a United States-only problem. It's going to be a worldwide problem, and it's probably going to happen at the same time because, as I said, if the dollar goes, so goes everybody else.
So the U.S. dollar is toxic right now?
Well, yes, and it didn't start that way. I mean, the dollar is basically, I don't know if toxic is the right word. It's not a bad word. You could call it that. I mean, there's a couple things I want to point out. One is, you know, how do we get on a dollar reserve system? I think that's important for our listeners. And one thing that we know is how it happened, and how it happened was very simple. After World War II, the nations of the world got together at a meeting at Bretton Woods. And during this meeting, they determined that the U.S. dollar would be the reserve currency of the world. And the reason that the U.S. dollar would be the reserve currency of the world was that the dollar was as good as gold. The U.S. dollar and gold were convertible at $35 the ounce. And because of that, the other nations said owning the dollar is as good as gold. In fact, when I was young, there used to be an expression that was as sound as a dollar or good as gold. Either one of those expressions was the essence that a dollar was as good as gold and that nothing could be sounder than a dollar. The reason the dollar was so sound was because it was backed by gold. And we actually had that payment system on an international basis from the time that Roosevelt made it illegal for Americans to own gold. That was internal in the U.S., but externally all settlement was done by dollars or convertible to gold until August 15, 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window and said, we're reneging on this contract. You can no longer exchange dollars for gold. We're going to let our currency float, and it's going to be based upon the full productive capacity of the United States of America. Whoever wrote that speech knew what they were doing because it gives a very strong impression of full productive capacity of America. I mean, that's you and me out there in the labor force doing something productive that's building wealth for everybody else. And that sounds great. But what it really means, and that's part of what it means, but what it really means is that the whole entire system is now based upon the taxpayer, and that the full faith and credit of the United States is based on everybody that works in the United States. And the government itself really produces nothing. Government has to take from somebody that's produced something and give it to somebody else. And that's the system in a nutshell. So it's been a road that has been steered down many times before. The short history of monetary systems is that they usually start off on an honest monetary system, and then they are corrupted into some type of fiat system where there's a substitute for gold or silver or both. And then there is a time period where things appear to be normal. And then the public, the citizenry, catch on to the fact that really the emperor has no clothes, that these pieces of paper really don't have any value. So people start taking those pieces of paper and exchanging them as rapidly as possible to somebody else to get something of value. It kind of reminds me of the game Old Maid when you were a kid. You know, no one wanted the Old Maid. As soon as you got the Old Maid in your hand, you want to get rid of it as quickly as possible and palm it off on somebody else. And that's exactly what happens at the end of these great inflations, is that people realize that this money really doesn't have anything backing it. It doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's really their belief in it. They're starting to lose faith in it. And the Chinese, for example, are really losing faith in the U.S. dollar right now. And so there is a rush to the exit. There's a rush to do something with them other than burn them for heat, and that is to exchange them for anything of value. So we're not there yet, but that is the direction that it's always gone in the past. And I have challenged any of my listeners or readers, or when I give speeches around the world, anyone that's got a different view, I'm certainly open to that. If anyone thinks that the dollar will survive, it's not going to go down this road that all others have gone in history, I'm open to hear it. But so far, no one's taken me up on the challenge and said, no, it's not going to happen. We're smarter this time. No, I don't think so. Human nature really doesn't change that much. Well, we have technology. No, that just means you can create more funny money faster. You know, God won't allow it to happen. I don't agree with that either. I think a lot of what we do, we have to pay our own price for. So I'm looking toward a new system coming on board here probably within the next few years that will be some type of dollar replacement.
This is Arthur Robinson, Jr. reporting for Michael Sinoff's ArtDefineSeminar.com.
So the U.S. dollar is losing purchasing power?
Yes, the dollar has lost a great deal of purchasing power. In fact, if you go back to 1913, where the Federal Reserve started, and a dollar was a dollar, and we'll use that as 100, you go to their website today, you can find it on their own website. This is not a number I've made up. This is verifiable on the Federal Reserve Board's own website. And it is that 1913 dollar is now worth about 4 cents. So they by themselves admit that their dollar has lost 96% of its value. And you always like to keep things in simple terms if I can. And it'd be like you having your son or daughter in grade school taking a 100-point quiz, and they come back with a 4. I mean, if they came back with 4 out of 100, I think you would consider that to be a terrible failure. And that's where we're at by the Federal Reserve Board's own admission. And what's really so ironic about this total failure is that their mandate is to maintain a stable monetary policy. In other words, their mandate, the reason they were created, was to make sure that the United States dollar was stable and secure and all the things that you have under an honest money system that you don't have under a fiat system. And, of course, they have failed miserably at this. But yet, very few people are aware of it because it's taken from 1913 till now. And now that things are getting so crazy out there, people are starting to wake up and question, well, why is this happening and what does it mean and how did it take place? And they're starting to ask the right questions. But it's happened slowly enough that most people, and there's still many that are unaware what's wrong. They feel something is wrong, but they can't put their finger on it.
So back in 1913, that's when the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank was created?
That's correct. There's a good book by my friend G. Edward Griffin called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and it's very in-depth research work that he did about how the Federal Reserve was created. And you know, there's arguments about, you know, was it lawfully enacted or not. I'm not going to get into that, but it did take place pretty much on Christmas Eve with a very small amount of governing bodies of the House and Senate available to vote, and it was kind of rushed through, and it wasn't acted by Congress. I mean, we can't say it was, and it was. Whether it's lawful or not, that's another question, but it's been the central bank of the United States basically for a long time. There's several issues around it that people that learn about it get rather upset. One is it's not federal, and two, it has no reserves. What I mean is it's not federal, even though it's called the Federal Reserve, is that it's a privately held corporation. It's not controlled by the federal government. And then having no reserves, they may own some gold. I don't really know. But most of what they have certainly isn't backed. It's just created at the whim of Federal Reserve Board and issued to the United States Treasury. So basically, rather than the United States government issuing its own money or creating money for the people, they have to borrow that money from a private bank called the Federal Reserve. And the way it works is like this. The government says, we need to borrow some money. So they call up the Federal Reserve and they say, well, how much do you need to borrow? Well, $1 trillion. And then the Federal Reserve calls the Treasury that works for them, basically, and says, we want you to print up $1 trillion in Federal Reserve notes. And the Treasury says, okay, boss. And they put the printing presses to high speed. And the Federal Reserve buys those at cost. So it costs approximately 3 or 4 cents per note. And that's what the Treasury gets paid by the Federal Reserve. Now, it's 3 cents to print a $1 bill or 3 cents to print a $100 bill. So it doesn't matter what the face amount is, they get paid 3 cents. They get paid of cost of production. Then they take that money and they loan it at full face value plus interest to the federal government. And then the federal government goes out and spends that into circulation with military expenditures, defense expenditures, welfare expenditures, education, housing subsidies, farm subsidies, and you know all the programs. There's literally thousands of them when you really get down to it. So that's how the money gets in circulation. Now there's the money that they printed for 3 cents, loaned at face value, and then there's interest on top of that. And the interest is owed by the government. But as we talked about before, the government really doesn't create anything. They have to take something from somebody that is actually producing something. So the interest that's owed comes to the tax system, and that is the full faith and credit of the United States people. In other words, it's all the citizenry that have to work for a living, have to make good on that debt created by the federal government. And that's why we're in the mess we're in. And when you can get something for nothing, there's basically no limit to how much money you'll borrow. And the federal government is guilty of that, as has been done many times in the past. If you look at the tulip bud mania in Holland, or you look at the South Sea Island bubble or the Mississippi bubble, it's basically the same thing. It's one giant Ponzi scheme, and that's basically where we're at right now.
So the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank is basically not an entity.
No, it is. It's a private corporation. It's a full-fledged, incorporated, I guess you could call it business, but it's not an entity of the federal government, even though it has that name. It's no more federal than Federal Express. I mean, we all know what Federal Express is. It's a privately held courier service. Well, the Federal Reserve is a privately held banking service, but it's not part of the federal government.
So all of our taxes are going back into that private sector arena?
Yeah, it's going back into, I would say all taxes, because I mean, there's taxes on everything. I mean, gas tax goes to the states, and that helps build roads, and property taxes go to schools and that kind of thing. But the federal income tax, the vast majority of it goes to pay off the interest payments to the Federal Reserve.
What do you think about the precious metals sector? In your opinion, where do you feel it's headed at this point?
Well, right now, I mean, I think we're in a what's called a secular bull market. And secular means a very long-term, very powerful bull market, but all markets go up and down. And a secular market, a long-term market, takes a long time. I mean, Japanese stocks were really the thrill in, you know, 1980 to 1990. But for you to make a lot of money in Japanese stocks, you had to buy pretty near the bottom, which was in the early 1980s, and sell out pretty much near the top, which is, you know, 89, 90, 91 in that time frame. And it's the same thing, I think, with the metals, only I think that this bull market's going to be probably about 15 years in duration. And the bull market started for gold in the year 2000 and silver in the year 2003. And I think we're going to equate it to a baseball game where it's a nine-inning ball game. There's no overtime. We're probably in the fourth inning or so in the precious metals. Most people really haven't caught on to what they are, what they represent, and what good they can do for the average citizen. The average person can benefit a great deal by having some holdings of physical gold and silver.
So gold and silver is God's made money?
Well, I'd say it is. I mean, the first money mentioned in the Bible is actually silver, and gold and silver are throughout the Bible. And, you know, if you're not religious, you just have to look at monetary history. I mean, silver has been used as money more places and more often for longer periods of time than any other element known to man, even gold. So if you go by history, then silver has been the money of the ages, and gold as well, but actually silver more so. And if you look at monetary history again, and you look at who were the most powerful nation states, I mean, for a great deal of time, it was Great Britain. And what were they based on? The pound sterling. What's the pound sterling? The pound sterling is a certain weight of silver. So their whole monetary system, when they were the strongest, was based on not a fiat system, not government decree, but on an honest system of a pound sterling, on the silver standard. And it was when they got off the silver standard that things started to go against them and they became less and less powerful. And that's at the time that the United States was coming up into its own, and it was on a bimetallic system, silver and gold, interchangeable. And because it had a sound monetary policy and productive workers, of course, I mean, there's a lot more than just the metals and the trust of metals themselves, but because of both of those, it usurped Great Britain as the major power in the world. And now what you're witnessing is you're seeing the United States waning, not doing as well, starting to really have some severe problems economically. And China is coming to the fore. It's coming to the front. It's making a lot of stuff that's imported to Walmart and lots of other places. And, of course, no one's on a gold or silver standard, but China has announced recently that they bought a great deal more gold than they talked about previously, and I predicted that, and many others, myself included, that China's probably buying gold very quietly. And it wouldn't surprise me that sometime in the future that China comes out and says the yuan is going to be gold-backed at this ratio. And if that were to happen, I'll say it's going to, I don't know, I suspect it could, but if that were to happen, then they would not only have the strongest labor force and producing more than anybody else in the world, they'd also have the strongest currency at the same time. And if that were to occur, they'd pretty much be unstoppable. Not that, you know, we couldn't compete. I mean, America's always had great competitive spirit, but I would just be suggesting on a global basis that what happened between Great Britain and the United States, where Great Britain's power started downhill and America's up, we're witnessing a similar event this time with China's power coming up and America's going down.
You're listening to an interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
So gold is hoarded and silver is consumed?
That is true. Gold is basically money. It's been perceived that way throughout its history. And it has two basic forms. One is, you know, gold bullion or coins, which is held as money, and jewelry. And gold jewelry, any place outside of North America, is pretty much considered money as well. Because when you buy gold in Dubai or any of the Mideastern countries or anything further to the east in China or India, or Southeast Asia, any of those locations, you buy it by weight. You might like one necklace over another necklace for its art form, but you're buying it based on its gold weight. In other words, what is its monetary value today? So jewelry, even in the Orient and in the Middle East, is money as well. Like in India, I mean, these women wear these bracelets, silver and gold, and they're taking their bank with them. That is their savings.
How do you feel about the derivatives market?
Well, I was one of the few that I know of. I got a very interesting film from one of my subscribers in Great Britain. And they sent me this docudrama. It was a documentary based on derivatives. It was called The Man Who Broke Britain. And I received this in the mail. And I thought, this would be very interesting. I thought it was about George Soros because of this currency trading, but I was wrong. It was this docudrama. It was a fictional documentary, and it was all about the derivatives exposure that was a global basis. And it was a very well-done film. And what I did was I took that and I clipped out about 3 or 4 minutes and put it all together. And I used that as a warm-up to some of my lectures. Ironically, when I spoke in London, throughout Europe, I did in the United States as well. And this is a very powerful film. I talked about how much money is in the derivatives markets and what kind of problems that really, really potentially held. And this, of course, was before the derivatives problem manifested and these things started to unwind and give us the huge problem that we're witnessing in the financial markets now. So I was ahead of my time, and again, I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of other people jumping up and down, screaming, saying this is a bad, bad thing that's going to cause some huge, huge problems, and it has. And it isn't done yet, as far as I'm concerned. The derivative situation is so huge and so vast, and all the banks are so intertwined with each other that we have not gotten out of this yet. Now, I know the mainstream financial press basically is saying that the worst is behind us, and I hope that they're right, but from my work, my study, and my research, I doubt it. We have not even approached the Alt-A market, which is an alternative mortgage stream that was probably worse than the subprime mortgage deals. These were mortgages that were very bizarre, just like the subprimes. That market really hasn't started into the phase where these payments are due. When it does, most all of them will not be able to be serviced. In other words, the people that own them won't be able to pay for them. So that will cause more defaults. So that puts more pressure based on derivatives. You've got credit card delinquencies that are accelerating. And I think more important than any of this is what's coming up on the federal government itself. You've got the FASB, the Federal Accounting Standards Board, and this is the department that requires the banking system and most of the financial system to report a mark-to-market valuation on their assets. So let's visit that a little bit. What they're basically saying is you're going to account for your household and you're going to put down your assets on one side and your liabilities on the other, just like any net worth statement. And you know that house that was worth $250,000 last year or 2 years ago, what's it worth today? So now you're going to have to tell the truth. You're going to say, well, it's worth $125,000. And those stocks that you own were worth $40,000 2 years ago or a year ago, what are they worth now? $20,000. In other words, you've got to mark down to what the market value of these assets are. Well, most of these assets are nothing but pieces of paper in the derivatives markets. And a lot of them are absolutely worth zero. They're not worth anything. And the banks are pretending as if they still have some value on their books. They're carrying them at, you know, some nominal value. But now that the FASB is going to require them to report it, once that financial information gets out into the top financial brains, we could say, where the people that really watch this stuff and know what it means, I think you're going to see that have a ripple effect throughout the entire economy. I believe you're going to see that become sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back, to use an old analogy. That is going to manifest the fact that things are much worse than we've been told by the mainstream financial press, and that basically there's no way out. Now, anyone that studies these markets knows there's basically no way out right now. There's no way that you can raise tax receipts high enough to pay off the national debt. And so what is most likely to occur is what's occurred many times before when governments have gotten into this situation, and that is to inflate the debt away. And that means some type of huge inflation down the road where the value of the money becomes worthless, and eventually becomes worthless or near worthless. So I could easily see over the next 2 to 3 years, and maybe sooner, where gold goes from like the $1,000 an ounce level where it's near right now to the $2,000 an ounce level. And yet, in real terms, in purchasing power, it hasn't done much other than what it's supposed to do, which is protect your wealth, because the dollar has decreased by 50%. So let me say that in a different way so it's very clear. If the dollar loses half of its value between now and 2 years from now, and gold goes from 1,000 to 2,000 in the same time frame, then basically all gold has done is protect your purchasing power, which is extremely important, by the way. That's why you want to own gold. But it isn't as if you made a $1,000 gain. What you really witnessed is a 50% loss in the value of your dollar. So anyone that held dollars instead of gold has just seen their entire worth, their entire saving, cut in half. And I believe that's the road that we're going down. So you may see things just continue to escalate in price, like food prices continue to go up and up and up, insurance costs, healthcare costs. And you may not see it in the housing sector. I could see where we might get the housing market to stabilize a bit, but we're so overbuilt right now, and most people can't take on new debt. I'm not sure even the scenario that I'm outlining would do that much for the housing market. I may be wrong, but I doubt it. So we have a very precarious situation where you could have inflating prices for everything that we need, like food and water, and for any asset that's based on a loan, like an auto loan or a credit card loan or a housing loan, actually decreases in price like we're experiencing now. So that spells trouble ahead for just about everybody.
Do you feel as though all currencies used to be backed by gold, silver, oil, and land?
As I said earlier, we've had times where they were backed by something and times where they weren't. And right now, as we know, they're not. But at one point, you know, the British pound was backed by silver, the U.S. dollar was backed by gold internationally. Most of your stronger currency, I mean, the Swiss franc was backed by gold for quite some time, and then they decided to cut it from its gold backing. So right now, as you said, none are. And will there be one in the future? We don't know for sure, but if history repeats, and it probably will, then somewhere, somebody's probably going to come out with some type of backing to their currency.
For more great interviews like this, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Can you educate the listeners about your take on the precious metals sector in terms of what you feel the true intrinsic value is in the silver and gold markets?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that been among my peers can cause a great deal of wringing of hands. Not everybody agrees. No one knows the answer, first of all. I mean, there is no exact. But one of the analogies that's used for gold quite often is that gold protects your wealth. It doesn't really make you wealthy or make you money. Now, even that is a bit of a fallacy, because there are times in history where gold actually does increase in purchasing power. So, in essence, it does make you money. But from a long-term perspective, it basically allows you to maintain your wealth, not to really increase it. And again, that's very important, because when you have a governmental system or quasi-governmental system that's basically bent on creating something for nothing, don't just keep creating more and more paper money until it becomes worth very little. So having gold protects you from that. Coming back on point, so what's the intrinsic value of gold? Gold, basically, going back into, you know, the early part of the United States, 1 ounce of gold, which is a $20 gold piece approximately, would buy a fine man's suit and umbrella and shoes and shirt and tie, and that's what $20 bought in, say, the 1900s. I mean, you're getting a tailor-made suit, shirt, tie, shoes, everything, hat, the whole works. And if you take gold today, you basically get pretty much the equivalent. So that's kind of a proof right there that, you know, gold maintains its value the value of that amount of metal, that 1 ounce coin, is the same. It buys the same thing. And you could do it for more than a man's suit. You could do it for an automobile. There's lots of analogies. And what you'll find, you do these little studies, is that gold maintains purchasing power. And again, that's what it's all about. So for silver, it's a little bit different story. There's been times in monetary history where silver has maintained its purchasing power. And in fact, it's more often than it hasn't. But there have been times when silver has not done as well as gold. And a few of these times has been when we're actually using silver as money, but there were great discoveries of silver. In other words, a great deal of silver would be like increasing the money supply, like I keep referring to, where, you know, printing money out of nothing. Well, silver as money, if you discover a whole bunch of it, you've increased the money supply rapidly, and that's what happened. The great silver discoveries in Nevada, the Comstock Lode, of a lot of new money being discovered, and that caused the price of every unit of silver to basically have less value because you just doubled the supply of money, essentially. So silver's had a mixed bag. I still believe in it. I think you should have both gold and silver. I think this time around, silver will actually do better than gold. But all we can do is report what, you know, the truth is. And the truth is that in times past, gold has actually been the preferred for stability, but silver certainly has held its own most of the time.
So if you increase the money supply, this economy will get stronger instead of weaker?
No, not really. The money supply, to be really sound and for everybody to have equality, if you will, if you could, the money supply would have to be stable relative to the amounts of goods and services produced by the society or the nation state or the community. So in simple terms, you would want to have a correspondence between the amount of money and the amount of goods produced. It's only when you have more receipts or more paper tickets or more paper dollars produced than there are goods and services that you get inflation. That is the definition of inflation. You have more money, quote-unquote money, not gold or silver, but fiat money out there than there are goods and services to back it up. And because of that, you get an increase in prices on basically all goods and services. Now, prices can go up for reasons other than inflation. Prices going up is not inflation. An increase in the money supply is inflation. So I want to be very careful here for our listeners. A price of something could go up or down based on a lot of things. A price can go up on something because it's getting scarce or it's in demand by the market. It could go down in price because manufacturing becomes more efficient. I mean, let's look at computers. I mean, computers, when they first came out, personal computers were, I don't know, around 2,000. I remember paying something close to that. And now it's probably not a hundredth or a thousandth as powerful as the computer systems that run the office now. But now it's been, you know, a couple of decades. So prices could go down even though as efficiencies go up. So it's not just a function of price. I want to make that clear. But as you increase the money supply, you keep making more and more money, you're decreasing the value of every unit of money that's out there. And then it can get into a situation where you have runaway inflation. That's what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany with the great hyperinflation. That's what's happening in Zimbabwe today. I mean, this is where, you know, it takes billions of dollars to buy a meal, you know, at a hot dog stand. So I'm not saying that's going to happen in the United States, but I am suggesting that we're going down that road. We're creating a lot more money, and it's not backed by any increase in wealth.
Are you more concerned about inflation or deflation?
You know, I'm concerned about both, and there's arguments that are very good arguments on both the inflation side and the deflation side. There's very much emotion around both. I mean, you got your very staunch deflationists like Ian Gordon and Robert Prechter and Bob Hoy. You've got some very staunch inflationists, maybe Jim Poplava and several others, Dr. Mark Faber, some others. And I gave a speech in January at the Resources Conference in Vancouver, British Columbia. And during that speech, I said I'm looking beyond inflation and deflation. And the reason I'm looking beyond inflation and deflation is I'm looking for an event that takes place very rarely. And that event is a currency crisis. This is where people basically give up on the currency. And that is basically the worst of all worlds because the whole system is based on confidence and trust. And if people don't trust a dollar anymore, you've lost all their confidence, then you have a huge problem in the financial markets because now now no one can value anything. They don't know what a dollar's worth anymore. They don't trust it. They want to get rid of it. They want to move it into something of value. And I believe that's the direction that we're going. That's pretty much more of the inflationary argument than the deflationary argument. But it's beyond the inflation alone. It's basically a currency wipeout. Inflation alone, you can get high inflation and bring it back and, you know, clean things up and get back to a system that is workable. And we've had that. We've had that from like 1971 up until maybe 2005 or 6, maybe 2007. But from August 2007 till now, we basically had a financial collapse, but no one really understands, I would say no one, but very few understand what's really going on behind the scenes and how bad the system is and how weak it really is and what the future holds. And that's why it's so important for people to get the word out there so people can at least hear it and investigate further. I mean, you don't take my word for it. Study on your own. Look at what I'm talking about. Look it up. You know, do some research. But we're in uncharted waters, as I said. We're in a system that's a worldwide global system based on the dollar's reserve currency. And the dollar is being shunned by nation states such as China. Japan's not real happy with it. Russia isn't happy with it. There's been meetings by the G7, the G8, the G20. And basically the whole theme of all those meetings recently has been, what are we going to do about this dollar problem? And no one really has an answer because these guys are all central bankers, and all central bankers believe that they're more powerful than our creator, that they can create this money and everybody's got to accept it. Well, that's not what history teaches. History teaches that the people can give up on this stuff and go back to something of intrinsic value. And I think that's where they're headed. So I think it's going to be rough. I think we can get through it. I think people are far more creative and imaginative than perhaps some of our leaders believe, but it's not going to be the smoothest of times, I'll put it that way.
So inflation is wiping out the poor and the middle class?
Absolutely. Inflation destroys savings, it destroys values, and I'll put something else out there not many of us talk about. And in my study, there's a direct correlation between the debasement of the currency and the debasement of the moral structure of society. So let me emphasize that a little bit. As the currency moves off an honest system where it's backed by gold or silver or both, and it's on a system that's kind of run amok where it is whatever I say it is today and you kind of believe me kind of thing, you see a moral decline go along with that. And part of it, I think, is that the people that are at the top of the financial system know full and well everything I'm explaining to you right now. And that gives them, I think, again, that gives them sort of this attitude that, you know what, it's just funny money anyway, it doesn't really have value, and as long as I can rip somebody off, it's okay. In other words, the moral decline goes hand in hand with the debasement of the currency. It's very sad. It seems that they have an honest currency, much more honest financial system and much more honesty in the overall financial transactions. I'm not saying that there aren't any problems with the gold standard. It's not perfect, but there's less, much less. Bankers are much more prudent with their loans. In my view, you would never see this subprime mortgage guarantees under a gold standard. The banker would say, no way am I going to loan on a house to someone that can't pay me back. This is insanity, or a bet that I'll make the loan because the value of the house is going to guarantee to go up in the future. A banker wouldn't do that under a gold standard. But under this funny money system, the morals decline. It's like, well, yeah, houses will probably go up. So, yeah, you don't really qualify, but we'll give you the loan anyway. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, common sense says this can't work, and of course it didn't. And that's one of many reasons while we're having the kind of problems we're having right now.
You're listening to an interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
I have to agree with you there, because I did some research, and I know that 90% of the bank's loans are sold to the secondary market, which is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
That's right. I mean, these loans were securitized. That's the word that's given. They were bundled up, and they were sold as investments, and these investments are sold all over the world, and that's why so many people, like in Europe, and I'm saying people, I do mean people, but I also mean more along the lines of financial entities, you know, banks and then insurance companies and brokerage houses and pension plan managers and this type of thing are so upset with the United States because these guys are pretty conservative. They want to buy an investment that's pretty sound. you don't want to put, you know, $1 billion into a major corporation into, you know, some penny stock. You want to put it into a bond that's guaranteed that it's going to pay you, you know, 6% forever. You want to be doggone sure what you're doing with that money. And so here comes these securitized loans built on a house of cards, but they've got this little tag on them saying that they're a very good investment that's rated at an A or AAA rating, which is from the rating agencies that is supposedly going to tell the truth about the quality of these loans. Well, it was all garbage. I mean, it was wrapped up in very high gloss paper with the best looking bow and ribbon you ever saw. And once you open up the package, after you bought it, what you found was a bunch of garbage. And that's why a lot in Europe and other nation states that bought into this mess is so upset, and rightfully so, with Wall Street, because these guys basically conned them. They told them this stuff was as good as an A rating when it probably wasn't worth a D rating. Basically, the whole system is a con game. It's built on trust, and the trust between banks and brokerages and everything else is broken down. And no one knows anything is worth anymore. So that's what's going on behind the scenes. And it won't be too long. The general public senses it, but they really don't understand it for the most part. They don't have time. I mean, this is my job. This is my living. This is what I do. So, you know, I got a fairly good grasp on it. But most people don't have the time to spend the amount of hours that I do researching this stuff. But I'm happy to explain it to them because it's vitally important. Because what's going to take place over the next 2 years is probably the greatest transfer of wealth that's ever taken place in the history of mankind.
In your opinion, do consumers have to become sellers of commodities?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'll just go to history. I mean, it's kind of what I base a lot of my work on. Again, history rhymes, it doesn't repeat. But basically, the end of all these great inflations, what you have happen is people decide what money is again. And this is already happening. I mean, what you see if you look at it closely is you've got private mints that are minting up, you know, gold and silver coins that you can buy. People are accepting gold and silver as payment for certain transactions. You're also seeing people come up with their own currency systems. I was at the Freedom Fest in Las Vegas recently, and a whole lecture was given on all these alternative currencies that exist in the United States right now. So people basically start to break away from the official system into an unofficial system. And sometimes those are commodities-based and sometimes they're not. But they're basically outside the mainstream system. And this is kind of one of the signs that I look for to say that, you know, we're getting close to the end, because in the end, again, the people actually decide what money is, not the government. And that sounds absurd, maybe, to hear that. But that's what starts to take place, and it is starting to take place more and more. So you'll see more and more people start to talk about, you know, precious metals or alternative ways to pay for things or bartering or whatever. People are very good at surviving. They're very good with their ingenuity. They're very good at survival. So you'll see this more and more, and that's what I think you'll see. I wouldn't say just commodity-based, although that will have a significant role.
How do you feel about portfolio money, stocks, bonds, and mutual funds?
Well, I'm not as radical as it probably sounded the whole interview. I mean, it probably sounded like, you know, you should just get gold and silver and forget everything else. And if I gave that impression, I apologize. I was asked to write the 10 Rules of Silver Investing back about, oh, 8 or 9 years ago for a book called Investing Rules. They went to some of the top thinkers in the financial markets, and they had everybody write down the rules for that specific market, like how to invest in stocks, how to invest in real estate, how to invest in mortgages, how to invest in mutual funds, how to invest in you name it. And I was asked to how to invest in silver. And the 10th rule that I gave during that time frame was that about 10% of your holdings into the precious metals was enough. So you could have 90% in, you know, other investments like real estate, stocks and bonds, insurance, you know, any of your mainstream investments, 10% in the metals, and you'd probably be just fine. That's what I said then. Since the time that that book was written, which, as I said, was about 9 years ago, till now, I increased it for my readers. I said before the Iraq war started that I smelled the war coming on, and I thought under a war environment, which is usually highly inflationary, that you'd be better off with an up to 20% holding in the metals. So I've gone that high. And, you know, I'm free market all the way. I mean, there are people that will never have any gold and silver. They don't believe in it, which I think is very unfortunate, but that's their choice. And there are people that think that aren't comfortable with 20%. There are people who want more than that. But as far as where do I stand, I think, you know, 20% is probably more than enough for almost everybody. But again, I think that anybody that doesn't look or study these markets carefully is making a big mistake going forward, because I believe gold and silver are your lifeline to what's going to happen. As I said a moment ago, and I'm sure you heard me, but I think we're going to witness the largest transfer of wealth in the history of mankind very shortly.
Is silver a base metal?
It's not really a base metal, but it's not just a precious metal either. It's a little bit of both. Silver has been, as I said, money more places for long periods of time than gold. But in recent modern times, silver has several properties that make it unique to industry. One is it reflects light better than any other element, and secondly, it conducts heat better than any other element. So it's used in almost all electrical and electronic applications. So there's a huge demand in a modern high-tech society for silver. And a lot of that silver is used in such small amounts that it ends up in the landfills or in the trash can eventually. Some of it's recycled, definitely, but not all of it. So it's kind of a dual-purpose metal. It's a monetary metal and an industrial metal or base metal.
This is Arthur Robinson, Jr. reporting for Michael Sinoff's ArtDefineSeminar.com.
This is some powerful information that you are expressing to me and the listeners. Now, what I would like to know, and can you educate the listeners about, how is platinum doing right now in this down economy?
Well, platinum is called the noble metal. It's referred to as PGMs, platinum group metals. The platinum's the best known. There's also palladium and rhodium and iridium and several under the PGM umbrella. Platinum is, and palladium, but primarily platinum is the one that we talk about and it's best known. There are platinum coins. Platinum's already been to $2,000 an ounce. I don't have anything against platinum. I like it. But it's something for a really high net worth investor. It doesn't have the monetary appeal that gold and silver has. It does have some. I like it. The real question wasn't about platinum and money. It was more about platinum and the economy. Platinum's used primarily as a catalyst. It's very important in the cracking of oil or distillate for diesel and gasoline. It's also used quite a bit in catalytic converters. So if the economy of the world were to really expand and really start humming again, and there were a lot more automobiles being built, platinum would probably play a significant role in the auto industry. It does, but what I'm saying is auto industry is actually not cranking a lot of new automobiles out right now. But if it were to, and China was to start producing low-priced automobiles like crazy, then there would be a higher demand. Platinum moves more on an industrial basis than it does on a monetary basis, although like silver, it does both. Again, I think platinum at this level, at the $1,200 level, probably a safe buy. I don't think you're going to get the amount of appreciation that you're going to get probably from the silver market. But again, it's a very rare metal. It's 10 times more rare than gold is. There's very little platinum mined on an annual basis.
Now, I went to your powerful website, and I was very impressed by the Morgan Report. Can you educate the listeners a little more about that?
Sure. I'll just give you the URL or the website address, and that is silver-investor.com. That's silver-investor.com, to use the proper language. And on that website, it's a two-part website. It's a website that's for free, which has a lot of articles that I've written, and I host a lot of other writers on there, and you can read it all, download it, print it out, do whatever you like. And then on top of that, there's a members-only section, which gives you my personal research and gives you recommendations on how to profit in the gold and silver markets. It's a resource-based, honest money. In fact, the subtitle of the letter of the Morgan Report is Money, Metals, and Mining. And that's what I focus on. I focus on money, what we've been talking about on most of the show, why things are happening the way they are, what I see coming ahead, and what to expect. So that's the money part. Metals, I talk about both silver and gold, sometimes platinum, palladium, sometimes copper, sometimes zinc or lead, but primarily it's the precious metals. And then mining, because for most investors, the way to get good, safe leverage into the gold and silver arena is to buy mining shares, because they're a lot safer than buying futures for most people. Because once you buy a stock, you can hold on to it. You're not going to have to worry about a margin call or huge moves, although these things can be tricky. And that's why it's probably best to get somebody to help you out and give you some due diligence before you go, you know, plunking your hard-earned money down on them. But that's basically the private part of the website. You get a password and a username, and you put that in at the top. You enter in, and you have access to our monthly report, a lot of audio, video, reports on mining companies I've done, special reports I wrote. I wrote a special report on Warren Buffett and why he bought silver. Some other authors, they got the permission to talk about where they see silver going. Some of them expect prices higher than I do. And they also send out personal emails from time to time, maybe on a company that we're following or something that takes place in the silver or gold market that warrants a quick update. I'll send that out personally using our system to all the paid subscribers. And then on top of that, if you're just really wanting to get started, I wrote a book called Get the Skinny on Silver Investing. That's on the website as well. It's a good read. It's a quick read. It's 100-and-something pages. You could probably read it in an hour's time. If you read that book, you probably know, 90% of what I know about the silver market. I mean, it's going to educate you pretty good level overall about the metals, but primarily silver market.
To the listeners that are interested in investing in the precious metal sector, can you educate them about how do you structure a precious metals portfolio?
Yeah, I'm a little different than most of the guys. The way I do it is I have big money and big companies, and speculations mean you bet a little to win a lot. You only put in money you can afford to lose. So I'm talking to people that are, pretty seasoned investors. I mean, there's probably people in your listening audience that, don't have money to invest, and if you don't, you don't. I mean, this is not the sector for anybody that doesn't have money to invest, and the speculative part of it is for people that have the ability to take a loss. But some of these things have done very well. The big companies are usually a little easier to buy and hold. They move slower. But there, too, all investments go up and down. I mean, you can't expect to buy an investment, and from the day you buy it, it continues to just go up and up and up. That's a novice's approach. It doesn't happen. All markets go up and down. But as we talked about, we've had a wide trading range for gold and silver, and that means that basically, and it's true, that all the mining equities, all the mining stocks, the ones that I recommend, have gone up and down right along with the metals prices because they follow the metals prices quite closely. The reason that you want to buy a mining stock is that there's leverage involved. So if gold doubles, then some of these mining stocks will quadruple or maybe go up 5 or 6-fold. So instead of doubling your money, you might make 5 or 6 times on your money. But the reverse holds. Gold goes down 20%. A mining company might go down over half or 60% or something. So you got to be careful. We do our best to help you time the market and also pick good solid investments you can hold for the long term. And also we give you some speculations you can put some fun money on and hope to hit a home run.
Now you mentioned mining stocks. Are there big margins in mining stocks?
No, unfortunately there's not big margins for profit in the mining stocks. Every mine is different, so you have to look on an individual-by-individual basis. But for the silver miners, there's very small margins at this time, at this price. Gold as well. Most of the gold miners have got some decent margins, but nothing extraordinary at this point in time. But that's, again, what you want to look for is as these gold and silver prices continue to go up, the margins become wider and wider. So, and that's explained in the book. I mean, I can't probably do it on the radio that well, but in the book, Get the Skinny on Silver Investing, it goes through why there's so much leverage to the upside for these mining companies.
Now, what is your take on the economics of this country?
My take is that it started out on sound fundamental principles. We had a highly moral society. People read a great deal, understood the basics of the law and private ownership, private property, golden rule. I mean, a lot of things. We had a very strong moral, strong financial base, and we built probably the greatest nation the world's ever seen, one of the most freedom that's ever been enjoyed anywhere. And it's been corrupted for the last several decades, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And I think we're in a system now that's almost the exact opposite of what our founding fathers envisioned. Our government is basically doing things that is not the will of the people. And under a constitutional republic. It's set up so that the government does basically what the voice of the people demand, and it hasn't been that way for quite some time. So I think, again, we're in for some rocky times ahead.
Let's get back to the precious metal sector. Why are they so important, and how much should an investor have?
Well, we talked about that. We said somewhere between 10 and 20%. The reason that they're so important is because it's the one money that stood the test of time. Gold and silver have been money for 5,000 years. It's never gone out of style. It's always worked. It's always known. It's something that has intrinsic value, and almost anybody on the planet understands that. So it transcends time, it transcends nationality, and it transcends government. So that's real money. That's always and everywhere true, and that's why you need it.
I'd like to thank you, David, once again for taking time out of your busy schedule to educate me and the listeners about the precious metal sector. Do you have any last pearls of wisdom for the listeners that are interested in investing in the precious metals?
To get real, buy real. And what I mean by get real is, get real with yourself. I mean, don't necessarily buy into what the mainstream press or mainstream financial press or the television tells you. You know, get real about it. Look at what's really true for you. Look at what the job market looks like where you live. Look at what the housing market's doing where you live. See what's real. And then buy real. And by buy real, I mean buy something real, like real gold or real silver. I don't sell bullion. That's not my business. I have it, and I recommend it, but I'm not a bullion dealer. But I recommend that you start there. I would never recommend that you start, you know, subscribing to the Morgan Report and start to buy mining stocks. That's after you've established a position in physical gold and silver. That's your money of last resort that will be with you as long as you need it. And once you've accomplished that, then you can certainly consider getting my report or somebody else's. But I'll leave you with that. Get real, buy real. It's one of my favorite closing.
And in closing, can you educate the listeners about, did you have any mentors that educated you when you started getting in the precious metals arena?
Oh, okay, yes. I have one that had a great influence on me is the great Harry Brown, who is now fairly long deceased. I got to be fairly friendly with Harry before he passed away. He wrote The Coming Devaluation and What You Could Do About It. He wrote How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. He wrote several books, wrote a newsletter. Basically called the top in the silver market, got very close to the top. Jerome Smith, who Harry knew, who I've never met, was sort of the silver guru during the last big run-up in the silver markets. He wrote several books, The Coming Currency Collapse, Silver Profits in the 70s, Silver Profits in the 80s, What's Behind the New Boom in Silver. Very big influence on me. Jim Sinclair still is around, known as Mr. Gold. He had an influence on me. James Dines with the Dines Letter, he had a big influence on me. Many authors across the board that wrote political science books or economics books from an Austrian school perspective. I'd say as far as the philosophy goes, the philosophy of money, Mises.org, Mises.org. If you look at the Austrian school thinkers, that's what I adhere to for my economic principles. Many great thinkers in there. Von Mises himself, of course, Hazlitt, Murray Rothbard are still in there. So, you know, try to be succinct about it. Say the Austrian school, Harry Brown, and people in that era that were prominent all influenced me.
Thank you, David, once again for educating the listeners as well as me about the derivatives market and the precious metal sector.
Thank you.
For more great interviews like this, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
That's the end of our interview with David Morgan. I hope you found it helpful. For more wonderful interviews on finances, marketing, advertising, copywriting, business, and health, go to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.